We are pretty strict, I guess, at home when it comes to devices and screen time with our boys. They already consider us over the top, and I don't even have teenagers yet. But for spiritual reasons and with the continued research that keeps coming out on the topic, we've just landed trying to be pretty conservative when it comes to screen time, which means going out to dinner as a family is really, really interesting. We want to teach the value of family. We want to teach the value of conversations, what it means to act right at the dinner table and how to have conversation with one another, which always, by the way, works better in my mind than it actually does when we try this. But I still keep holding on to the ideal of what I hope it could be one day for our family. But we were out to eat the other night, and I look over, and there's a family of four. And the dad is buried in his device, presumably checking his work email. I can look over my shoulder and see the mom who's on hers, and I swear to you, I've never seen anyone be able to like, comment, and swipe as fast as this woman was liking, commenting, and swiping whatever platform she was on. And there's two boys at the table, and one of them, headphones totally on, over the ears, you know, enveloped in the screen, whatever TV show he was watching to keep his attention. And then the last one with his device kind of going back and forth, presumably some sort of racing game or anything. And I just watched for a few moments, and, you know, it was peaceful to the degree that there was nothing being said. But I just couldn't help but just wonder what's going to be the long-term ramifications for something like that. And listen, I don't want to be too harsh. I realize that's kind of the new normal. But honestly, it makes me a little bit sad that that's the new normal. There is no doubt, and research backs this statement up, that you guys in particular, but we, I'll put myself in there because I'm living now, are the most overstimulated generation in the history of the world. More things at our disposal to keep our attention. Think about this. You now have access to over 900 channels on your television, and yet we still say, there's nothing to watch. I'm bored. Okay? Now, when I was growing up, I can remember a time when we had 30 channels, and I thought, wow, that's a lot to choose from. All right? No joke, all right? Suzanne could tell you. There's probably less, right? Remember when there was only like three or four? Yeah. So like 30. Yeah, when there was none. Yeah, that was before my time. But yeah, when there was just nothing, right, to even entertain yourself. And so now we have access to all of this and even streaming capabilities, yet we still are bored. And so then the worst punishment for me was this as a kid. Well, aside from my dad's belt, that was pretty hardcore bad. But next to that was go to your room. Now, why was that punishing? That was like going to Alcatraz into solitary confinement. There was nothing in my room. There was a bed in my room and my clothes in my room and maybe a few toys that I had in my room, but there was no television, no Wi-Fi, no devices, no Nintendo or any kind of gaming device, no telephone, no nothing. And so to go to your room was literal punishment. That was, like, especially for an extrovert like me, to take me from outside or where I had things that I could do and say, go to your room, was like a death sentence, okay? Now, I realize for you guys, that's like, that's where I live already. I have everything I need. I don't even have to leave my room, and I have everything I need. Now, that's not how it was for me. I just had to sit there and figure out how to entertain myself until I had served my time, and I was allowed to come out. Well, we've been in this series, Facing Giants, and each week we're trying to identify some of the common giants that all of us, myself included, will face and realize this great truth. God has already defeated them for us. So if there's anything to walk away from this series, it would be remembering God has fought on our behalf and he has won. We are not David. Jesus is David. He has defeated not only the giant, he's defeated all of our giants and gives us the opportunity to walk through life with him as he fights the battle for us. So no matter what your Goliath is, you can rest confidently tonight knowing not that your battle is over, but ultimately that giant has been defeated. And so he's fought and he's won for us. He continues to fight for us and give us what we need to face our giants. So far we've talked about the giant of fear. And that's kind of where we started, looking at, you know, fear is kind of underneath all of the giants. But in particular, a lot of us are bound up by anxiousness, by anxiety, by fear, by worry. Then we talked about the giant of rejection, one that hits all of us, either words that are said or actions that have taken place where we feel like, hey, we just don't measure up. We've been rejected. And then we talked about the giant of comfort, maybe a different one to talk about, but to realize that so many of us, that's not actually a good thing. That's actually problematic. To have this giant of comfort that we're driven towards, it just kind of lulls us into realizing we're not at war. And then last week we talked about the giant of anger. Well, tonight we're going to wrap this series up with our last giant, the giant of addiction. We're an addicted generation. I don't know how that statement hits you. Chances are you're able to blow it off a little bit because none of us would be willing to admit that we're as addicted as we are. Just say the word addicted or addiction in a room of people and watch everything change very uncomfortably quickly. Right? Because no one wants to recognize or look internally to see, is this me? So typically you say the word addiction and your mind races to the biggies, right? Alcohol addiction. Drug addiction, all right? Porn addiction. Oh, we hear the word addiction and we think the word that most is closely associated, rehab, right? Where somebody who has an addiction has to go away and get professional help and to deal with these big issues. And then we breathe a sigh of relief because we go, well, hey, that's not my story. I don't have to deal with those issues. I don't know if you ever saw the show. There's a show on A&E now, I think it's in reruns, called Intervention. They still show some old episodes you could catch. But the basic premise was this. There was family members or a group of friends that had such care and concern for somebody whose life was spiraling out of control and an addiction. Typically was one of the biggies, maybe a spending addiction, maybe a drug addiction, an alcohol addiction, didn't matter what it was. And so how the story would play out is they would, in essence, have to kind of trick the person like, hey, so-and-so, I want you to come over to your aunt's house this afternoon because we're going to help her with some work around the house. The person would walk in the door, and then all of a sudden they walk into a room where there's all the people, their friends, family members, loved ones, maybe a therapist, a psychologist, psychiatrist, sitting there, and they sit down and have to face the reality that we are staging an intervention. Something in your life is so out of control that we're calling you to the carpet on it, and we're going to deal with it right now. And they were powerful, and they were emotional, and some of them turned out really, really well, and some of them turned out really, really badly. That process didn't go well because when you confront people in their addictions, usually one or two responses take place. If they've hit rock bottom, there's a sense of honesty and there's a sense of, oh, thank you. Thank you. I've needed help. Or there's a sense of they're not there yet and what goes up? Walls of defensiveness. How dare you? How dare you call me out on this? Look at the problems in your life, right? Deflection back to the other person. And that's how they usually kind of landed and played out. And listen, the big addictions, they are real, make no mistake. But I don't want any of us tonight to kind of slide back in our seat and say, well, Todd, since I'm not dealing with one of those big ones, then I really don't have any addictions in my life. Because I'll tell you, for all of us living in this culture, and especially you in this generation, there's a wider net that we've got to cast when it comes to this word addiction. We can't just narrow it down on these biggies. There's addictions to all kinds of things, big and small. Think about the reality that most of us always have to have something going on. We always feel the need to fill our minds with something to entertain us or distract us. Like I told you, a family can't even sit down for dinner without the eyes of each person being glued to a screen. But make no mistake, entertainment's not the only addiction that we struggle with today. What's yours? What comes to mind when I say the word addiction, when you hear or think about the word addiction? I'm going to ask you to press in on that tonight, even though I have a feeling it's going to be uncomfortable. Uncomfortable for me as I was preparing, thinking this through in my own journey and in my own story. Let's start with kind of a working definition so that all of us can understand what I'm after. An addiction is simply this. I would say at the very base level, an addiction is something we can't live without. Meaning I've got to have more of this. I want more of this. I can't live without this. I often ask the question this way. Think about what the thing would be in your life that if it were taken away, you'd be really angry. That's mine. I deserve to have that. Could be a literal thing, a material possession. Could be a relationship. Could be any kind of dynamic that you're living with where you would be shaking your fist at God saying, how dare you take that from me? Chances are that will reveal what you're clinging to as an addiction. Maybe you're enslaved to something, or it's a habit that you can't break, or it's a person you can't separate from, a pattern you can't change. And ultimately, any of these things can be harmful. And if they're left unchecked, the addiction devastates our lives and everything around us. So make no mistake, this giant of addiction is real and it is powerful. And it will lead you down a path, not only of destruction, but at the very base level, just simply unfulfilled promises. Because they can never deliver on what they promise. I don't know if you've ever processed the fact that not only are addictions powerful, but if you really think, they're amazingly illogical. All of us could reason that it makes no sense to choose a harmful path, but yet how many of us are on one or have been on one, right? We know logically this is not a good direction to go. Then why do I keep going that direction? Why do I keep doing that thing? Why do I keep landing in this place? And so addictions are often like those snowballs that start really high on the mountain, really tiny. And as they go down, what? They just gather and gather and they pick up everything in their path. They gain steam and become larger and larger until they come crushing in on our lives. And we go, well, it was just so small. I thought I had it under control. Until we realize we're in an avalanche. For some, it's a drink just to fit in at a party. Don't even like it, but I'm just going to try it. It turns into one day an alcohol addiction. Others start with a simple puff of what seems to be a harmless drug. I mean, my gosh, look at all the states that legalize it. It's accessible everywhere. Go in the bathroom at school and you can smell it, right? I mean, it's everywhere. But then what happens? What happens when it becomes meth or coke or heroin or a full-fledged drug addiction that's left behind a wake of destruction? Some people are addicted to money. You can't get enough of it. You always want more. Maybe yours isn't money. Maybe it's a relationship. And then a relationship, you know, physicality starts to grow. And it starts off innocent and seemingly harmless. And you're hoping to stay pure. But one touch leads to another. And eventually sex becomes an addiction. And maybe it's not in a relationship. And so it's not physical sex. Maybe it's the virtual kind. We all know that porn is a huge giant standing in the middle of even this very room, shouting and taunting, you will never break free from me. I know the reality that some of you feel. One click, next thing you know, it's an addiction. But what about some of the more seemingly innocent ones? A hunger for the latest and greatest just kind of grows to where buying more and having more just doesn't become fun anymore. Now all of a sudden it's a coping mechanism. I use it to distract me and so I can't stop buying. What about accomplishments that become an addiction? The athlete that's so driven to have the perfect body or be able to master the perfect skill or sport. Or what about even academics where it's such a drive. I've got to be able to take just one more AP or have the most APs or hit that my grade point average is never enough. I think I could just keep working and inch it higher and higher. And then the next thing you know, even accomplishments. I've got to be recognized as the best. It's an addiction. What about adrenaline? You just can't simply slow down. Because in order to slow down means you have to face the reality of the hard places in your life, and you don't like to think about those. And so you medicate by staying busy. Because if I'm busy, I don't have to think. And I like the adrenaline rush that comes with it, and it helps me avoid the silence and the pain that exists in that silence. Speaking of pain, some are addicted to pain. How crazy that even to alleviate pain, we would bring pain on our lives, cutting ourselves, harming ourselves in such a way that distracts us from the bigger pain or the deeper pain. What if you're addicted to people? What if it's a certain group of people? You know what I believe the most widespread addiction out there is? The addiction of the approval of others. And where do we see this most in your generation and culture? In social media, right? Social media sticks a knife into the addiction of approval and it twists the handle in a big way. Why? Because I've got to not only post the perfect photo, but I've got to come up with exactly the right words, so I've got the perfect caption to go with that photo. And then what do? We wait. We wait for the approval shown by likes. And if I hit the number that I'm looking for, if it exceeds that, then all of a sudden I am happy in such a way that I can live with myself or engage with my life in such a way that I feel satisfaction. What happens when I don't get what I'm looking for? When the comments don't come in? When the likes don't come in? And then what? My identity falls. Now I will say this, if social media, it can be used as a way to celebrate others, if it can be used as a way to talk and connect even globally, most certainly if we could talk about Jesus and the gospel, then hey, social media can be great. But I'll tell you this, if social media is where you're getting your approval, if it's your drug of choice, it will kill you. You can tweet that out. We'll die under living for the approval of others. So let me give you a question to ask yourself. What problem is occurring in my life that I need to mask the pain or the emptiness with an addiction? What is going on in my life where my natural go-to, instead of dealing with the pain, is, you know what, it's easier to run towards this because this brings me relief. This brings me comfort. The addiction, porn, shopping, approval. Listen, these are only the symptoms. The cause lies underneath the symptom. And I'll tell you, the root cause of most addictions is pain, relational pain, emotional pain, physical pain. Look below the surface of your life. Find the pain and give it a name because that's your cause. The symptom is whatever addiction shows up hoping to alleviate that pain, promising to make you feel better. But I'll challenge you tonight, you got to look beyond the symptoms and try to dig a little deeper and say, what's going on underneath this? What's driving it? Fortunately, there's hope. I know it hasn't sounded like that so far in this message, but guess what? We've already said Jesus is our David. He continues to fight for us. He has defeated the giant of addiction. And so the challenge is, instead of running to an addiction, run to Jesus. Because you can live confidently and securely when you're immersed in intimacy with God. Let me show you this from David's life. We've been looking at his story out of 1 Samuel chapter 17. And so when David comes and he gets ready to engage in battle with Goliath, King Saul says these words to David, verse 33, "You are not able." Let me just pause there for a moment. Those words are hard to hear. Those words most certainly would leave a mark in anyone's life. The king saying to this young boy, listen, you're not able. He goes on, you're not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him, for you're but a youth, and he's been a man of war from his youth. Now, you may read it. It may sound like concern from King Saul. Like, wow, he just cares about him. He wants to protect him. But I don't think it was concern at all. I think it was an attempt to make David feel vulnerable, to make David feel exposed. Here was Saul, the mighty warrior king, the man who stood ahead above anybody else physically, the man with amazing skill, the man with age and experience and wisdom, having a suit of best armor, having the best sword there. But yet, have you ever thought about this in the story? Well, then why wasn't Saul challenging Goliath? If he was the biggest and the best that the Israelites had to offer, why wasn't he out there challenging Goliath? Here's what he does do. He wants David and everyone else to know that the boy was going to fail. And I think he did this to mask his own insecurities, his own fears that he couldn't face. Yet look what David says in return. He stays amazingly respectful of Saul, of Saul's position, speaks from his experience in life. Verse 34, let's pick it up. But David said to Saul, "Your servant used to keep sheep for his father. And when there came a lion or a bear and took a lamb from the flock, I went after him and struck him and delivered it out of his mouth. And if he arose against me, I caught him by his beard and struck him and killed him. Your servant has struck down both lions and bears, and this uncircumcised Philistine shall be like one of them, for he has defied the armies of the living God." And David said, "The Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine." And Saul then says to David, he changes his tune really quickly, "Go and let the Lord be with you." Saul sees something in David's confidence, and David's confidence didn't come from his own abilities. It's not like even though killing a lion and a bear is amazingly impressive, it is, but that doesn't necessarily equip you to go against a 9-foot-tall giant with a sword. And David wasn't trying to tout those things to say, "Look at what I've done." What David was saying is, "Look at what God has done for me. And if God has always been for me and never failed me, then I have no doubt that going into this battle, it would be no different." His confidence doesn't come from his ability. It comes from God's faithfulness to him. Saul should have heard that and agreed, but his own security, Saul's own insecurity, caused him to doubt God and then add to this. Remember, because what took place right after that, he goes, "Okay, we'll go, but here, take my armor with you." But Saul's armor proved to be nothing more than a cover-up for what he thought David's weaknesses were. Saul wanted David to look strong and more protected than he thought he really was. And you know what? That's us too. Don't we do that? We put on false armor all the time. If only I could look better than I really look. If only I could give off the impression that I'm more secure than I really am. If only people would believe this about me. Why? Because we feel powerless in a broken world. We're afraid. We feel open to attack, and so we hide. And where do we hide? We hide in addictions. We hide in things that make us feel better, that make us look stronger, or that simply distract us from the real issues of our hearts. But David had to drop the armor. Look at verse 39. David said to Saul, "I can't go wearing these things." He says, "I haven't tested them," but in essence, he's going, "This just isn't me. These don't fit. This is not what I'm used to. This is not what my confidence is in. I'm not trying to put on a show. I'm not trying to hide behind something." So he goes out to fight the giant with just himself, his sling, his rod, and his God. I think that's a pretty good template for our lives as well. Yet we've got to fight our original temptation. And I say original because it goes all the way back to our first parents, Adam and Eve. They chased addiction too. What'd they chase? The addiction of, "Hey, I just want to do what I want to do. Hey, God can't tell us what to do." Or, "Hey, God's keeping something from us. We actually know better." And their addiction led to shame, led to hiding. They couldn't handle the vulnerability of being naked anymore. It's really profound when it says in Scripture that they were naked and unashamed. The two became one flesh. They were naked and unashamed. That's far more than just a physical dynamic going on there. There was an amazing spiritual and a relational dynamic going on. To be in our nakedness and to be unashamed is something that will come again one day. It has nothing to do, again, with the physical. It has everything to do with the emotional, the spiritual, and the relational. But then all of a sudden, what comes crushing in? Oh my gosh, I'm ashamed. I'm naked. I can't be exposed. I can't be vulnerable. So where do they go? They go and hide from God. They cover themselves. I can't live this way. I've got to find a covering. I've got to run to something that will ease the pain that I'm feeling. And guess what? We do the same thing thousands and thousands of years later. We repeat the same pattern. In our vulnerability, in being exposed, I can't handle this exposure, so I run and hide. I run to something that masks the pain, something that covers me up, something that makes me feel better about myself. We run to addictions that hide the real us because we don't want anyone to see what we know is below the surface. So David had to go into battle as his real self. He was confident walking in vulnerability because of his relationship with God, and he was confident because of his intimacy with God. He lived exposed before God. He knew what it was like. He knew he wasn't alone. And he knew his God was more powerful than the giant. And that's why he said to Goliath, look at verse 45, "You come with me, you come to me with a sword and with a spear and a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you down and cut off your head. And I will give the dead bodies of the host of the Philistines this day to the birds of the air and to the wild beasts of the earth, and all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel, and that all this assembly may know that the Lord saves not with a sword and a spear, for the battle is the Lord's," that's good to remember, "and he will give you into our hand." Let me finish just by talking about this word vulnerable. Let me point out to you the last four letters in that word vulnerable. Able. Within the word, some of us fear is the answer. What some of us most fear, being vulnerable, really we find the answer, and it's this: we are actually able. Well, wait a minute, Todd, I thought you said we're not David. Well, we're not. Jesus is, and that's why we're able. We're not able in and of our own power, but in the power of God in us. That's what David tapped into when he said, "I don't need this armor. Don't give me all this stuff. I can just be me because I know who God is in me. I know what God has done for me. I know what God will do for me in the future." When we're weak, 2 Corinthians 12:10, what does it say? "For when I am weak, then not he is strong," even though we know God is strong, but what does it say? "For when I am weak, then I am strong." How does that formula work out? How in the world, when I am weak, I am strong? It's because it's not me. The I is connected to the Christ in me, Paul says, the hope of glory. So, here's what I'll tell you. You've got two choices when it comes to vulnerability. And the first is this: lean in on the negative sign of vulnerability, and this is where you'll be. You'll feel continually inadequate. You'll feel continually unable. Going this direction will always take you to the end of your rope. It will take you to hopelessness. You'll run to addictions. You'll run to hide. You'll run to cover yourself, because in your vulnerability, shame will drive you away from what you need most. So what do you need most? The second option: lean into the person of Jesus Christ. And when you feel vulnerable, admit your weakness, yet rest in his power. Because that's what Paul says: when I am weak, that's when the realization is that I am strong. We come to Christ leaning in on him with no cover, no mask, no hiding. He loves us just as we are. He meets us in our weakness. He makes us strong. So how do we do this practically? Three quick ideas. The first is this: talk to him in prayer. And it starts with this: "God, I'm powerless. I cannot break this addiction myself. Otherwise, I would have done it already. Wouldn't you? And here's what I know. You've tried." How do I know that? I have too. I can't tell you how many times I've prayed, "God, I am so sorry. I will never do that again." And if I'm lucky, with good willpower to make it maybe a month, only to find myself a month and a day later praying, "God, I can't believe I did that again. This time's different. Never going to do it again." Willpower, try harder, only to fail again. Look, if you could do it, you would have already done it. So we start in prayer. "God, I am powerless." You tell him your need. You be honest with him about where you are right now, because, hello, he already knows. He sees into the depths of your soul. But your telling him is what builds intimacy. It's what built what David had, this confidence to stare down a giant and say, "I'm really not afraid." Because I know who I'm connected to. I know who is with me. Christ accepts you in His love. He infuses you with His life. We're vulnerable, yet Jesus is able. Secondly, rely on His grace. If you are ever willingly going to choose an addiction, choose this one. Be a grace addict. Be so consumed and connected to His grace. Because guess what? Because of Jesus, your giants have already been defeated. The news couldn't get any better. We ought to cling to that and celebrate that, be addicted to that, live in that. We would rest and rely on that promise that you can take your brokenness, your struggles, and you could try to go to an addiction to cope, or you could run, instead of harming yourself with an addiction, towards Christ, run to Jesus, exchange your weakness for His strength. That's His grace to us over and over and over again. And then thirdly, walk in His power. You've got to face reality that something in you has changed, whether you see it or not. We just don't always live like it's changed. And don't believe the lie that you can't fight these giants of addiction alone. Please don't buy into that lie. You can't do it alone. You already know that. I know. But we buy into that lie. I'm not going to tell anybody. I can do this. I'm scared to be vulnerable, so I'm not going to tell anyone my struggle. I can do this on my own. I'll get out of this on my own. How well is that working for you? All it does is produce greater shame and guilt that piles on us. See, we're afraid of opening up. We're afraid of revealing our weaknesses and being vulnerable. But being able comes from being honest with God and those around us. That I would be able to stand up here and say any of my struggles, any of my imperfections, and none of you, your jaw should drop and go, you? Who do you think I am? Who do you think you are? How could any of us ever look at one another with, I can't believe you? If you do, that just shows how little connected you are to your very own heart and struggles. Every time I've risked being vulnerable, I've always been met from people that love me and that I trust with, I'm with you. I'm with you. I may not have that same struggle, but man, I know how weak I am. I'm with you in that. And you'll never meet a Savior who doesn't say, I already know. And I died for that. I died to save you from that, to give you the power to be free from that. And so we start believing and apply the promises from His Word that greater is He who is in us than he who is in the world. And I'd want to leave you with this last reality, and it's this. You realize that everyone who has ever done anything great for God has done it with some sort of weakness. You realize that? Minus Jesus. He had no weakness. Anybody that you idolize and look up to in the faith has done it with a limp, has done it with a weakness. And we're strong through this weakness because of Christ in us. And so, do you want freedom from your addiction tonight? Run to Jesus. Celebrate your weakness, which I know sounds weird, by admitting your vulnerability. And let Him pour His strength in your life. He will trade your weakness for His strength. Let's pray together. Father, would You meet us in this place? God, I know in this moment there is nothing Satan would love more than to whisper in our ear, it's not talking to you, let it go. To whisper into our ear, hey, it's not that big of a deal. To whisper into our ear, hey, you've got control of this. We rebuke him, we reject him because he is a liar. We don't have this. God, would you meet us in our vulnerability and maybe even our fear to be open and to share. And that doesn't mean all of our deepest, darkest secrets or details, but just to be honest about our struggles. First and foremost with you and then with one another. That's what defines community. That's what should define community here in our high school ministry. And God, that community starts in a relationship with you. And as always, I'll pray every chance I get for anybody who has never trusted in you, to seeing you as the great and glorious one, the Savior of their sin, that they would turn from their self and trust you to begin a relationship with you tonight, God. If we don't have anyone here that's like that, God, put a burden on our hearts to bring somebody that could hear this good news week after week. But God, for those of us that know you, I pray that your Spirit would move in us tonight, shaping us, challenging us as we face our giants. Thank you that you've already defeated them. We pray this in your great name. Amen.